This story involves aspects of addiction and self-harm. Listen with care. Hey, how are you? And if you say you're fine, I'm gonna assume you mean like the acronym. Freaked out, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. So, have you heard the term lifequake? Well, in this podcast, we talk about lifequakes, those unpredictable seismic shifts that, in time, lead to profound personal growth and empowerment. Here, you can expect heartfelt stories that reveal both the joy and the discomfort of unexpected change. And I think you're going to like it here. My name is Sean, and this is Something Shifted. Today's story belongs to SJ.
The shift for me was having to come face to face with my biggest fear. On my own, two small kids, facing a future as a single parent. That was my fear, doing it alone.
That's next. I know you're busy and planning what your family will eat isn't always top of mind. Well, that's why we love YouCook, and I can give you 50% off your first order. YouCook has really helped us eat tasty, nutritious food, and it saves me from spending time in the shops because they deliver all of the ingredients for my chosen meal kits right to my door. YouCook's always adding new recipes to the website, and I've even picked up some new skills because of their easy-to-follow recipe cards. And because YouCook gives you exactly what you need for each recipe, you never waste any food. I love the convenience, I love the variety, as well as the flexibility of their meal kits, because you can choose 2, 3, or 4 different dishes to feed 1, 2, 3, or 4 people. And in that way, you're staying in control of how much you spend. Everything on the website looks amazing. And if you don't want to cook at all, then grab a few of their ready-made meals to stash in the freezer. Weekend boxes, desserts, pizza, lunch boxes, wine, they've got it, and you can have it for less. Go to youcook.co.za and use my code #shift50 and pay half price for your first order. Go get it, shifters. That's youcook.co.za and use the code #shift50 at checkout to get 50% off your first order. Do it today. This is a story about love. Although it's not a traditional love story. It's about love addiction. The fear of not being loved. The kind of love that can keep you alive. It's about a mother's love. About facing your greatest fear and learning to love yourself through it all.
I always think of healing as peeling the onion. And it was time to go to another layer of the onion. I had to. That's when I realised, stop worrying about, I'm traumatising my kids, and peel the, can I swear? Peel the fucking onion.
If you're an avid radio listener, you might recognise SJ's voice from a Cape Town talk radio station. And based on her accent alone, you'd be correct to assume that she grew up in the UK. But her accent doesn't reveal the affair her biological parents had in the 1980s under Apartheid's Immorality Act. In her first book, Killing Caroline, SJ reveals the shocking lie created to cover up her birth parents' forbidden relationship and the hurried adoption of their illegitimate baby. Named Caroline at birth, she was renamed Sarah Jane after being abandoned by her birth parents and then adopted by a British couple. SJ was only 7 weeks old, and this history means her family tree has many branches.
Jeepers. Okay, oh gosh. So, biological mother, biological father, don't know biological mother, do know biological father and my siblings from him. I have a half-sibling from my biological mother who I don't speak to. I have an adoptive mother, my adoptive father has died, my adoptive mum lives in the UK. I had an adoptive brother, he also died. Where do we get to now? My current setup is that I am a mum of 2 children.
So, depending on how you look at it, SJ is either one of 2, one of 5, or one of 8 children. And maybe all this complicated branching is why SJ decided that if she ever had kids herself, she would do anything to protect them. And also why she did not, under any circumstance, want to be a single parent. Let's be clear, there are many people who are fantastic single parents, who even seek it out as a life path. But SJ only wanted to parent with a dedicated partner. And part of that reasoning about parenting and partnership comes from SJ's original quake and not being raised by her biological parents.
And that has had the most profound impact on me than any other thing in my life, that relinquishment. It has set up who I am and why I am the way I am. It's my why, largely. Not that I'm in bondage by that. I don't feel held hostage these days by that. But it's set in motion an awful lot of things. Feelings of being less than, feelings of not being good enough, my own addictions that spurred from that, my relationship with my adoptive mother, so many things, because it's such a pre-verbal trauma. There's no, you don't exist before trauma has come into your life. You're 7 weeks old.
This is the fundamental fracture, that irreversible quake in SJ's life. SJ has endured many things that would make most of us cower in a corner. But the one thing that she feared the most, being a single parent, happened in 2023.
I made the decision when my son was about 4 months old that I told my partner, you have to leave.
I told you this was a story about a mother's love, and that part of the story will become clear. But it's also a story about the kind of love that keeps us alive. Love that wrecks us. And love addiction. So to appreciate the depth of SJ's decision to become a single parent, to hold her story in our hearts with empathy, we need to journey back to 2007, when SJ was 26 years old and in a rehab clinic.
I was in treatment. I was in rehab for various addictions and behavioural addictions. And I was in a different treatment centre, and I'd started self-harming again in this treatment centre. And they're like, we can't hold you in this space. We are here for people who've got addictions. We can't be dealing with, you need to go somewhere else for a bit. And ended up in a Kiso clinic, a Kenilworth clinic. And one day there I was, and I used to have my arms like bandaged from elbow to wrist. And I was walking down the hallway, and the most attractive man that I'd ever seen in my whole life walked down the hallway towards me and literally took my breath away and sparked some sort of hope or joy or something in me that I hadn't felt for a really long time. Like, I was on suicide watch at the time. I was trying to take myself out every day. It was a really bleak time. And down the hallway walked this person. And this person is now the father of my two beautiful children, nearly 20-something years later.
If you've ever watched a series or a movie where a character is battling addiction and is in treatment, you'll have seen a healthcare professional give that patient very strict instructions to not develop a romantic relationship, especially not with someone who is also battling addiction.
He was in Kenilworth Clinic for a heroin detox. He was a heroin addict. You know, they say in these treatment facilities that, you know, no fraternizing for obvious reasons. You know, and if you start getting a little bit too close to somebody, they come in. The nurses used to say, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. They'd say to him, keep talking to her, keep talking to her, keep talking to her.
We're going to call this man Enver. This is not his real name. Enver would sit with SJ every day, holding her hand, talking to her, and giving her a reason to stay alive that day.
He literally saved my life at that point, at the age of, 26, 27, when all I was trying to do at that point was find ways to avoid the nurse, escape from the asylum and try and kill myself. And that meeting at such a profound time of my life, that's in there, that's embedded in my limbic system somewhere. Then there was me and him, and our relationship has been a very, very complex one, but suffice to say, we've stayed around each other long enough to conceive two children.
If you've journeyed with addiction yourself, or with someone you love, you'll understand this. The complexity, the messiness, the realness of a love that saves and a love that hurts. If you've not lived with or near addiction, we need you to suspend judgment here and to let go of any assumptions that you might have about addiction.
Addiction is something that starts as a very useful mechanism to prevent pain. You know, Gabor Mate talks about a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. It is an absolutely direct response to trauma, whatever that trauma might look like. I know people don't, when people say trauma, but nothing ever happened to me. Trauma can be a pattern of behavior. It can be a dysfunction. It can be an event. It can be a number of things. It can be an abandonment. It could, whatever it might be. But it is, the addiction begins as a protection mechanism to protect oneself from that, which we want, we want to do that. We want for that to happen. But then, because we are not then, as addicts, given the adequate tools to deal with the thing in a safe way, that becomes our safe way until it's no longer serving us in that way, until that looks as if it's the problem. Mm. It's never the problem. It's the unresolved trauma for all of us. People can get very hooked on, why don't you just stop? Because it's a disease of the mind and it's a disease of the body. It's a physical thing. And then it's also, the mind is such a powerful thing.
Ever since she started treatment, SJ has been committed to healing. And part of healing is learning to understand the mechanisms that she'd been using to build a life around that original fracture of abandonment.
As much, I've been clean and sober for 18 years, but my biggest addiction is codependence, the love addiction stuff, the attachment, essentially, which all kind of probably harps back to, well, not probably, I know it does, to being adopted at 7 weeks old and all of that kind of stuff.
SJ has been committed to her healing journey and working on her sobriety since she left the rehab clinic. And Enver continued to be a very important person in her life. And in 2019, they decided to start a family. When the 12-week scan came around, the couple found out they were having a baby girl. It was also in that time that SJ found out Enver had relapsed and was using heroin again.
And then I didn't see him again until the day before I gave birth. So I went through an entire pregnancy, essentially, completely alone. It was horrendous. And to the point where I'd called my brother in Joburg and said, I'm going to give birth on my own. Can you come? And he said, yeah. And he came down from Joburg. And we were at Musenberg. And I remember my ankles were so swollen. I was giving birth on the Wednesday. It was Tuesday evening. And I said, I've got to go and put my feet in the water. And I had sent a message to Enver's mum, who had also completely ignored me throughout my pregnancy, his entire family. It was awful. And I sent a message and I said, tell your son his daughter's being born tomorrow. I hadn't heard a word from anybody for months and I wasn't expecting anything to happen. And my phone rang and it was him and I hadn't heard his voice for 6 months. And he said, hi, babe. And I said, I'm giving you a 48-hour pass to come and watch your daughter being born for her sake, so that when she's older, I can say your father bore witness to your entry into the world. And so the next morning, I got up at, 6:30 in the morning, and I went to the house, his parents' house, to go and fetch him. And he looked like you would probably imagine a heroin addict who'd been on the street for 6 months looked. ill-fitting clothes, very, very thin. He looked shocking. And we got in the car and we were driving to the hospital to go and have a baby. And as we were, as I was driving, he said, "We need to stop. You need to stop here." And about 50 minutes later, he came back on, came back into the car without his shirt on. And he had literally sold the shirt off his back for heroin to use before, because he wouldn't make it through. He wouldn't make it through the birth without having used.
SJ's vision of parenthood was coming apart at the seams. She was alone, without any family in Cape Town, with a baby and a partner in active addiction, while the world was in the grips of a global pandemic.
We had managed to claw back through the universe's grace, and 12-step programs, an awful lot of therapy. We'd managed to start piecing together some semblance of a life. We'd got to a point where he'd got clean and life started to look like things could be really good.
At this point, Enver was 2 years sober, and that's still considered early recovery. SJ desperately wanted another baby, so they decided to add to their family of three. Their son was born in December of 2022, and although Enver was technically still sober, SJ had started noticing some warning signs.
But I was noticing that the things that are required for somebody to do to stay clean, and not just physically clean, but emotionally sober, which for people in recovery is very often 12-step meetings. It's a connection to, we talk about a higher power. It's connection. You know, Johan Hari says the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection. And I'd started to notice that he wasn't doing those things. And the fear that welled up in me of, I can't be a single mom again.
But because SJ had continued to do the inner work in her journey, she knew full well that the fear came from her own fractures and wounds.
My core is to hang on. Is not, don't be abandoned, don't be abandoned, don't be abandoned. So I'll hang on to things that I should be letting go of. And so there was, yeah, there was the fear of, I can't do this on my own. I don't want to do this on my own. And it was like this monster that was just growing and growing and growing and growing. And the fear was so multi-layered. It was, I alone am not enough for my kids. It was, I'm not going to be able to protect them from the trauma that I experienced as a child, that now as a parent I will do anything to protect them from being traumatized, and yet this is the one thing that I don't know if I can do.
This is the part of the story about a mother's love, the kind of love that gives you courage to step into fear.
And then when my son was about 4 months old, I thought, if things carry on this way, he's going to relapse, and I can't have my kids around that. I was still dealing with the trauma of his using, relapsing, getting clean, relapsing, getting clean, of when our daughter was born and the first couple of years of her life. I was still processing that in therapy, like what that was and how crazy that was. And now it had happened again, and I had not one but two small children, and I was the main breadwinner. My biggest fear had just happened, and yet I was the one that had told him to go. I'd facilitated that. So that was the quake. The worst thing in the world that could happen to me as I exist is happening, which is that I am a single parent and it's all on me.
SJ did the hardest thing and faced her biggest fear, and the wheels, they came off completely.
I don't have family here, and the loneliness and aloneness of it was breathtaking. I was postpartum. I was trying to feed a child, you know, I had a kid on the boob. I had one who was just a little bit over three, whose dad had disappeared, the idol of her life. So this man who used to tuck her into bed at night, wake her up in the morning, bath her, do her hair, her god had disappeared. And I was trying to deal with that, his abandonment of us, and every abandonment issue in me just going up, up, up.
The truly hard part about this is that in so many ways, we've lost the essence of the village that helps raise a child, that step in when the parents need help.
Nobody jumps up and down and says, let's come and help. Everyone just goes, oh, she just has to get on with it. She'll cope because that's what we do. Except that very often we're not coping.
Not only was SJ not coping, she was also doing a job that required for her to switch the microphone on and pretend that she was doing well for the sake of the listeners.
We're like, morning, weekend breakfast, SJK, could you, you know, and do this whole thing. And the mask was exhausting. You press that button, the red light goes on, and all the cuck that you're going through, it might as well not be happening. I would come off air and be drained. And also feel like a fraud because so much of my personality and so much of what I want to bring to my radio show is authenticity. But nobody knew what was going on. And how broken I was. I was just broken. I just used to cry myself to sleep at night into my pillow because I didn't want to wake the kids. I got sick one day. I was at work. I was on air. By the time, show started at 7, by the time 10 o'clock, dripping sweat, barely drive home, and the nanny who was looking after my kid, God bless the nanny, I mean, she needs a shout out because she put up with a whole load of shit, she was leaving. And I had no one. And I literally put on Facebook, which I am not, you know, it's not my thing, I'm here with two kids and I'm ill and I need help. Strangers turned up to my house. Friends of mine in Durban called people they had in Milnerton who came through to the southern suburbs and helped me look after my kids because I was bedridden.
It makes sense why doing parenting alone was the scariest thing SJ could imagine. Remember what she said earlier? That the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. And as a recovering addict, SJ knew she was choosing to sever connections. She was signing up to be alone when she told Enver to leave. And the thing that feeds that loneliness is shame.
An awful lot of people had walked the journey with Enver and I. And they'd been present for an awful lot of the relapses and that he's clean again and the relapses. And I felt embarrassed. I thought people would be like, well, you had a second baby with him. Particularly people who didn't understand addiction. I felt ashamed.
Because most of us do not really understand addiction, we tend to approach it with rationality and rules. But it doesn't work like that.
Addiction is such a curious beast. We talk about it in the rooms as being cunning, baffling, and powerful, in that one assumes if your partner and the father of your children is an active heroin user, of course you're not going to allow them to have contact with you and your children. The relapse happens in the mind long before somebody picks up the drug, whatever that might be. And we talk about the idea of a dry drunk, somebody not working a program of recovery, but abstaining from the addictive behavior, the substance, but not doing the work that allows you to, you know, addiction is a manifestation of a thing. It's not the thing. The substance is not the thing. And, you know, again, all the time that somebody is not actively engaged in the behavior and that switch hasn't gone off in the brain, I always say, even if they're not working a program, and I'm saying they, but I should speak for myself as a recovering addict as well, there's all... You've still got what are they saying? And something in the game. There's still hope. Once the addictive behaviour, that first hit, the first whatever it is, all bets are off then.
So even though SJ knew this about addiction, it still felt personal, like a punch to the gut.
I used to go into therapy and just say, but why? But why? But why? How does he do it? I was trying to get, rather than looking at myself, and I think this is where the growth factor then came. For a long time, rather than looking at myself and what compelled me to stay in a situation of in that way, by this point, I was probably 14, 15 years sober myself. Most of my friends are recovering addicts. I know the stuff. But when it's that close to home, it's almost like you can't. I was trying to make sense of it. I needed to make sense of it in a way that wasn't just, but SJ, you know why? Because it's addiction. There's nothing else outside of that. There's nothing. This isn't you. He's not doing this because it's you. He's not doing it. It's his own journey that he's on. You know this. But I could intellectualize it, but I couldn't feel that because it feels so personal. When somebody is in addiction, their behavior towards you, you're so incredulous that somebody can feel that way and behave that way. You feel as if it must be personal, and it isn't. You can jump up and down, you can swear and shout at them, you can be loving to them. If somebody's not ready to get well from addiction, there's nothing you can do. You know, I am powerless over another person and their addiction. And what it forced me to do was really start doing the work on myself.
It takes enormous courage to choose the path that you fear the most.
Trying to heal when you are going through your own quake, your own emotional upheaval, emotional catastrophe, trying to heal for the sake of two little people who are looking to you for everything is one of the hardest things. And I'm someone, you know, I've always been committed to my recovery. I've always been committed to emotional growth, always. So I would say to my therapist every week, my therapist is brilliant, thank God for her. I would say, I'm messing up my kids. And she would say, SJ, you are committed to doing the work. You keep showing up. You keep showing up. And at that time, it fell on deaf ears. I felt like she was just, it was lip service. I'm paying you to say that. I realize now that she wasn't.
SJ made it through long, lonely nights, many cold Cape Town winters, many of the things that she feared the most. And through it all, the fear of abandonment, love addiction, love that breaks, love that heals. SJ has learned to love herself through the journey.
First of all, you can't stop your kids feeling pain. That's going to happen. Someone's going to break their heart. This is going to happen. And the people that are causing the pain might even be you at some point. What you can do, though, is continue to heal so that when they come to you and say, this thing you did hurt me, rather than come from a point of defensiveness and say, well, I can hold them in that and engage with them in that, which is a gift I was never given, ever. The bond that I have with my kids now also is just extraordinary. It allows me to keep doing the healing work, whatever is coming up for me at any given moment. And that all feeds into being able to just keep doing it a day at a time. My kids will be okay. I think that's my biggest thing. Recovery is possible. Mm-hmm. Recovery is entirely possible. And I know that because I experience it for myself. And I know that because I surround myself every day by hundreds and hundreds of people, probably thousands in my lifetime, who a day at a time are living clean and sober lives. Mm-hmm. It is possible. I've seen people come from the streets to being happy, present fathers of their beautiful children. The quake was the biggest gift that could have ever happened.
Today, SJ lives with her two beautiful children in the southern suburbs of Cape Town and has authored two books, Killing Caroline and Mad Bad Love. Thank you so much for listening to this season of Something Shifted. We make the show as a labor of love and because we believe stories about possibility is just what the world needs to hear. We'd really love it if you would share Something Shifted with others and be part of the shift for someone else too. And if you really love the show, go ahead and leave it a 5-star review and follow Something Shifted on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Don't forget to use my code HASHSHIFT50 at checkout when you place your first order on ucook.co.za and you'll get 50% off. All of the links to all of the things that I've mentioned are in the show notes. A big thank you to my wife and executive producer, Ruwenda, for additional writing. And of course, to you for believing in possibility. We'll be back with more stories later this year. My name is Sean, and this is Something Shifted. Bye.